It's Philosophy Talk.
The members of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists Science and Security Board find conditions in the world to be so threatening that they are moving the hands of the doomsday clock 2 minutes closer to midnight.
Why would a world leader ever decide to launch a nuclear attack?
Everybody can see that to initiate omnicide, as the philosopher John Somerville called it, I can't imagine anyone who would say that is a rational, sane, reasonable thing to do.
Is it ever ethical to even threaten to start a war that would annihilate most life on Earth?
You couldn't make that threat if you weren't prepared to look as though we were prepared to do it.
They're talking about nuclear war.
How do we justify keeping so many nuclear weapons?
Or threatening to use them?
When you do that, you are using the weapon.
Our guest is renowned whistleblower and former nuclear war planner, Daniel Ellsberg.
The Doomsday Doctrine.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Hi, philosopher. Thanks for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk.
And thanks so much for being a partner in Philosophy Talk. Now, you've supported us in the past, and we're really grateful for that. But we need your help now more than ever. We need your help to make more of what we know that you love.
So here's how you do it. You go to our website, philosophytalk.org, and click the I Will Help button. It will really help.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for thinking.
And thank you for donating.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
How can we end the threat of nuclear annihilation?
Is mutually assured destruction a form of collective insanity?
Is there any role for nuclear weapons in a reasonable defense policy?
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Cubberly Auditorium on the Stanford campus.
Continuing conversations that begin a stone's throw away at Philosopher's Corner, where Ken teaches philosophy and I did for 40 years.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about nuclear doomsday.
Yeah, but why worry about nuclear doomsday now, Ken? The Cold War is over. We had 30,000 warheads pointed at the Soviets. They had even more pointed at us. I think we're down to a fraction of that. A climate doomsday seems more worth worrying about.
John, you gotta realize there are still enough weapons in each country's arsenal to incinerate the Earth, cause a nuclear winter, and extinguish practically all, not just human life, but all life on this planet.
But why not take comfort in the fact that exactly one country has ever seen fit to use a nuclear weapon? That was over 70 years ago.
One country so far. But more countries are getting into this nuclear act all the time. I mean, now there's India and Pakistan. There's Israel. There's North Korea, for crime's sake. Some terrorist with a dirty bomb may be the next one. Look, the more players there are with nukes, the more likely they are to be used again, don't you think?
Well, no, I don't know. When we dropped A-bombs on Japan, we had a nuclear monopoly. There's nothing really to deter us from using them. But since we lost that monopoly, and there's been this mutual deterrence, not a singular nuclear weapon has been unleashed.
Yeah, but John, we've come close a couple times. I mean, I know you remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, I'm sure. And you remember that during the Berlin Crisis, President Kennedy, when a national TV, and in the middle of his speech, urged Americans to start building fallout shelters. You remember that, right?
I remember it very well. My folks listened to the broadcast and built a fallout shelter. Then a couple years later, when the Cuban Missile Crisis came, Frenchie and I were ready to drive up and get in their bomb shelter when Khrushchev started removing the missiles.
So
Khrushchev saved the world and saved us from a long weekend in a very small place with my folks.
But look, John, given that you lived through that, how can you possibly be sanguine about nuclear proliferation?
Well, I'm not sanguine. I'm not sanguine about anything. I just recognize, while in a perfect world, no nation would have any nuclear weapons, we don't live in a perfect world. As long as U.S., Russia, and China and others insist on having huge nuclear arsenals, you can't expect other countries not to have at least small arsenals.
But that kind of thinking, that's that right there. That's a recipe for disaster. Come on.
Well, or a recipe for a nuclear standoff. I mean, if you've got nuclear weapons and I don't, you push me around. Look what happened to poor Gaddafi. Well, not poor Gaddafi, the jerk Gaddafi. If you and I both have them, you don't mess with me and I don't mess with you, like Kim Jong, what's his name, in America. Disarmament would be great, but a standoff beats both nuclear war and nuclear domination.
That's like the NRA's bogus argument that, oh, we're all safer with guns everywhere. But look, more weapons in more hands doesn't make us more safe. It just means more chances for accidents, more chances for strategic miscalculation, more chances for chest-thumping brinkmanship, more pressure to get ever more powerful weapons. Look, if we want nuclear safety, we've got to break the nuclear wheel, John.
But how do you propose to do that? You can't expect nations to unilaterally disarm. You can't expect the U.S. and Russia to have mutual disarmament with China waiting in the wings, waiting to be dominant.
Look, think about it this way. Nuclear weapons are mostly useless anyway, so why not just give them up?
Useless?
Well, come on, ask yourself. Did nuclear weapons save the Soviets from defeat in Afghanistan? Or did they forestall the collapse of the entire Soviet Empire? Did they prevent America's debacles in Iraq or Vietnam? Have they helped Israel? You know, their undeclared nuclear arsenal, everybody knows they have. Has it helped them solve their Palestinian problem? They're useless.
You're thinking of it in the wrong way, maybe. Nuclear weapons are meant to be useful in a way that a cocked and loaded gun is useful, as an instrument of intimidation.
Oh, God, except that if you actually have to fire your cocked and loaded nuclear weapons, well, then you fail, right? And then the next time that somebody actually does fire them, it will almost certainly be the last time that either they or anyone else gets to use this cocked and loaded gun. That's a pretty limited form of utility, I'd say.
Well, Ken, there's a lot to think about here that we usually don't like to think about. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to remind us just how fraught the history of nuclear weapons and nuclear technology more generally has been. She files this report.
These days, when you think of total existential planetary annihilation, you're probably thinking about climate change. For good reason.
If we do nothing to keep glaciers from melting faster and oceans from rising faster and forests from burning faster and storms from growing stronger, we will condemn our children to a planet beyond their capacity to repair.
But for Kate Brown, who's a professor of science, technology, and society at MIT, there's another reason to lose sleep.
America has around 4,800 nuclear warheads, which is more than enough, not just to destroy Earth, but to provide 4th of July fireworks for Martians.
The only thing that calms me down is not thinking about it, frankly.
The threat of nuclear technology. It's receded from our collective fears, but Brown says not for any rational reason, just from a kind of recency bias. Nothing terrible has happened in a while.
We are alive today and have not encountered nuclear Armageddon, really only just by chance and circumstance.
Nuclear weapons are becoming easier and cheaper to build, and it's not unlikely that other countries like Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia might get them in the next 20 years. North Korea keeps adding to its stockpile. And you don't have to imagine a hypothetical wartime conflict escalating to the point of a nuclear attack. All it takes is a small mistake.
There's been so many close calls, nuclear weapons falling out of planes. There's been very close encounters where American planes violated Soviet airspace, and the Soviets thought it was an attack.
Making matters worse, the latest hypersonic missile delivery systems mean if a country thinks it's being attacked, it doesn't have hours to decide how to respond. It has minutes. If a country misinterprets a signal, it could be too late.
The more these missiles populate the Earth, the more danger we are in.
When we think of a nuclear attack, we imagine a big blast that flattens a city. But nuclear warfare is a lot like chemical and biological warfare. After the pyrotechnics are over, the long-term manifestations of that 1 millisecond flash of a bomb continue for centuries.
radioactive contaminants damage DNA, chromosomes, organs, so that people develop cancers later in life. They develop cardiac problems later in life. Birth defects are an outcome. So that the repercussions of nuclear warfare continue for generations, 10 generations and offspring.
Worldwide, what we've had since these technologies were first introduced is rising rates of cancer, rising rates of birth defects. Male sperm count has been cut in half since 1945. But we've never adequately funded research investigating the causation between those things and the nuclear radiation from atmospheric testing of weapons during the Cold War. From the beginning, nuclear technology wasn't just about weapons. It was supposed to be the beginning of an era of free energy.
Here, in fact, is the answer to a dream as old as man himself, a giant of limitless power at man's command. And where was it science found that giant? In the atom.
Since its commercialization in the 1970s, nuclear power has prevented the emission of about 64 billion tons of carbon dioxide. It's because of these virtues that nuclear technology has been allowed to proliferate around the world. But it's also why we can no longer contain the threat of nuclear weapons. One of our greatest hopes for salvation is also one of our greatest liabilities. The scientists have always known this, of course. Robert Oppenheimer from the Manhattan Project, he knew it.
He knew the world would not be the same. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks, Liza. Very interesting piece showing the good things and the bad things that nuclear energy has been fraught with. I'm John Perry, along with my Stanford colleague, Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from Cumberly Auditorium on the Stanford campus.
Our guest today is a former nuclear war planner and a renowned Vietnam-era whistleblower and the author of a wonderful book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Daniel Ellsberg.
So most people my age know Daniel Ellsberg as the hero who took a generation of us and showed that our worst fears were true about the Vietnam War, and then showed that fears we hadn't even had were true. Daniel Ellsberg, by the time he was 27, was already helping people at the RAND Corporation and the Defense Department think about nuclear strategy. So how did a 27-year-old end up being in that kind of position?
I was invited to the RAND Corporation because I was interested in a rather abstract theory called decision theory, in the theory of rational decision-making under uncertainty. How do you act reasonably when you don't know the consequences of your actions? And that was looked at that time, not so much by psychologists or people who really knew much about actual human behavior, but on a very abstract level. But once I got there, I discovered a very practical question, which I threw myself into for the next many years. And that was, how do you deter the Soviet Union, which was supposedly building up the ability to destroy the United States, to disarm the Strategic Air Command, SAC? They were supposedly ahead of us in the missile gap with what the head of the Strategic Air Command estimated in 1961 were 1,000 intercontinental ballistic missiles. Even a few hundred, even 30, could have disarmed us pretty much and made it impossible actually to retaliate. They would have been masters of the world. That's what my colleagues believed. I respected them very much. They were very smart. And they were being told this by the intelligence services, who were lying to them. So we were lied into a delusion. The actual reality in 1961, which the Army and Navy was saying, but it didn't serve them. They were saying there were a few ICBMs at a time when the Air Force was saying from hundreds to 1,000. The answer was they had 4. The problem that I was working on as a 27, 28-year-old was a illusion, actually, how to deter them from launching a surprise attack, which they had no ability and obviously no intention to do.
So let me ask you a question, though, because one of the things you did, you went and you asked people hard questions. And one of the things that really kind of interests me is what the doctrine was under the Eisenhower administration. What would cause us to launch a nuclear war and what we would do? I don't think people realize what we were up to. Well, and then you managed to change that, and I wonder if you think that was progress or not. But tell us about the Eisenhower era.
I didn't manage to change it. And a number of presidents who wanted to change that did not manage to change it, and it's essentially the same now. And it was started actually under Truman, not even under Eisenhower, at a time when we had a monopoly of nuclear weapons. So our weapons were not to deter attack in the first instance. The Russians didn't have anyone. None of them did. Our weapons under Truman, going up to 1952, was the basis of our NATO strategy. And remember, Eisenhower at that time was the general in charge of our NATO strategy, but he was under Truman at that point. And the strategy was that if the Russians go into West Berlin or West Germany or anywhere else, Yugoslavia, which had broken away from them, Korea, where they didn't go and so forth, we will hit every city in Russia and China because there was a Sino-Soviet bloc. So even fighting Russians under any circumstances, we intended to destroy all aspects of the Sino-Soviet bloc and as many people in that bloc as we could.
Okay, this is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Cubberley Auditorium on the Stanford campus. Our guest is writer, activist, and renowned whistleblower and former nuclear war planner Daniel Ellsberg.
In our next segment, we'll get into the logic of nuclear war and nuclear deterrence. Is there such a thing as a limited nuclear war? What would it mean to win a nuclear war? What would cause a rational national leader to even contemplate initiating nuclear hostilities?
The madness of mutually assured destruction, along with questions from our audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Tiffany Austin Quartet. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is former nuclear war planner Daniel Ellsberg, and we're thinking about nuclear doomsday.
What would limited nuclear war look like? How could you tell the winners from the losers of a nuclear war? How would their dead and shriveled bodies look different?
So, Dan, I have a hard time. I can imagine an evil, diabolical leader launching a nuclear war, but I have a really hard time getting my head around the idea that a rational actor could calmly and deliberately, not evil person, could choose to initiate nuclear hostility. So I want you to put me inside of the head of a moral national leader faced with this choice and show me how such a leader, I mean, put your decision theory at it, might reason his or her way to actually launching nuclear hostilities. How would that work?
Look, you said, could a nuclear war be limited, and could it be won? Well, yes, we've had a limited nuclear war. World War II ended by dropping nuclear weapons on an enemy we knew did not have nuclear weapons,
right,
and we won the war. Could that anything like that happen now? Absolutely. Attack with nuclear weapons a country that doesn't have any and right, doesn't have an ally. That's no joke. That would include Iran. We have a national security assistant right now, John Bolton, who has been asking us to launch a preemptive war to prevent Iran from ever getting a nuclear weapon. And his point, like that of the Israelis, is they must not be allowed to have it. We've got to attack them first with could be done with non-nuclear weapons. But Richard Cheney called for nuclear plans against, actually, to wipe out Iran. Those were exposed back in 2006.
That would be one.
We wouldn't get any nuclear weapons back.
Are you telling me then, okay, if you've got a monopoly, then a rational actor would say,
which
I'm
we
going
do.
To exploit my
we
monopoly.
We do have a monopoly against most countries
right,
in the
right.
world.
So that would be, rational?
To wipe out millions of people?
You're the decision theorist. So I want to figure out, I'm acting rationally. What could lead me to do this horrible thing? I mean, what's the rational calculus?
Well, ask John Bolton. That's a hard one, actually, for Iran. The purpose, actually, he has been said for 20 years, which is what the Israelis say pretty much, is we don't want Iran to have a nuclear weapon. We don't want North Korea to have a nuclear weapon, which it now does. Bolton wants to attack both. Now, Iran actually couldn't retaliate. We'd kill millions of people. Would it be a victory? No, we'd have Iraq and Afghanistan for the next 20 or 30 years, but we wouldn't have lost the war.
Let me ask you a question.
But okay. Russia is a different matter.
Yeah, because they can retaliate. Okay, so what
well,
would...
Well, not just retaliate. North Korea can retaliate. North Korea could, in fact, by sending a boat into our harbors here, kill hundreds of thousands of people, but we would eliminate them, and many people, like Bolton and others, would say, we've won the war. In a certain sense, we have. The world wouldn't have blown up. But now let's get to Russia.
Okay.
That's what you were really talking
right,
about.
Right.
We threaten nuclear war, even to initiate it. Both sides do. Both sides. Putin and the U.S. and NATO continue to say, if we had to, if we were being beaten with non-nuclear weapons, we would initiate nuclear war. Could that be limited? No. People have worked at that question for over 50 years. They've never come up with a plausible, although sometimes individuals convince themselves they can believe anything. Humans can.
So that, wait
but
a
nobody looking at that says it can really be limited.
So, wait
so
a
why
Doesn't
would you
it
do
follow?
That?
So, wouldn't it follow from what you just said? This is what I was trying to say to John. Nuclear weapons, especially against a nuclear adversary, are useless? I mean,
no.
There's no rational calculus that could lead you to do that. You just told me there's no rational calculus that would lead... Right, unless you're going to just intimidate the arm.
Unless that's what they're for. Intimidation is what they're for. And that's why they're valued. Although I think the real impulse here before is it's very profitable to make them. And that works in Russia, which is now a capitalist country, in the same way that it does here for Boeing and Lockheed and their equivalents. But even on a strategic level, I'll give an example.
Okay.
Berlin, many people will say the threats have never had any effect. There wasn't any real threat, and nobody believed them, et cetera, et cetera. Only one thing kept Soviet troops out of walking into West Berlin and making it part of East Germany. It was 250 kilometers inside East Germany. There were 22 Soviet crack armored divisions in the vicinity of Berlin. There was no way for us to keep open the access to Berlin, as we committed to do in front of NATO and everybody else, except the threat of initiating nuclear war and the readiness to do it. And every president made plans for that, made preparations for that, had no other alternative, and actually it worked.
But at the risk of blowing up the world. You agree with John. The utility of a nuclear weapon is like the utility of a cocked and loaded gun that you're marching.
Yeah, like the John that you wrote
like
the part for in the beginning.
The utility of a cocked and loaded weapon. I've got my cocked and loaded weapon. Do what I say.
Yeah, and when you do that, you are using the weapon.
Right.
You couldn't make that threat if you didn't have the weapon and if you weren't prepared to look as though we were prepared to do it. We have used our nuclear weapons in a couple of dozen crises, most of them secret from the American people, use it in the exact way you describe. Point it at somebody at the head, you're using the weapon.
Yes.
And I'm saying in West Berlin, that worked. The only problem was that it had a genuine possibility, at some moments, even a probability, of blowing up at least the Northern Hemisphere and in reality, killing nearly everyone on Earth.
But I want to get down to cases. Let's take Eisenhower. My whole family loved Eisenhower. They loved Bob Taft more, but they liked Eisenhower. I thought Eisenhower was great. I thought he was rational. I thought he was courageous. He promised us that there was this football and he was in total control of nuclear weapons. You tell us that's a lie. But for him to say, you know, don't do that or we'll
blow up the world.
Look, was he fooling himself? Was he fooling them?
Yeah.
Are they all involved in some kind of flim-flam on the whole rest of us so they can remain in power. What the hell's going on when people deter people from doing things by saying that they will do things that make no sense whatsoever?
Almost no one that I know of, and I studied this a lot, civilian or military, has wanted to initiate a nuclear war. They prepared for it, but not because they want to initiate it, and that's true on both sides. They want to have the ability to threaten it, both in retaliation, in kind, if we should be struck by a nuclear attack. But as I say, this all started when we had a monopoly, and we had a superiority for a very long time. The main thing was a threat of initiating nuclear war by us. And to threaten that credibly against Russia is not so easy because the retaliation is so great. So we have to build up, we said we had to build up, Lockheed and Boeing said we had to build up, and there are people who went in and out from the government, to have the ability to disarm Russia in case we got close to a war, so we wouldn't get retaliation. Can we disarm Russia with what we have? Can the Russians disarm us? No. But we can pretend we can, and we make a lot of profit in the process, and we can tell our allies, we are successfully deterring them, and therefore we deserve hegemony in the alliance.
Let me ask you this. There's a United Nations pledge. We will not be the first users of a nuclear weapon. Everybody in the world signed that except for a handful of countries, including us, and yet all leaders I remember claim they wouldn't
doesn't happen to be true. Russia, for a while, in 1980, and actually earlier, in 1986 and 1979, but in 1980, Russia did unilaterally declare no first use. We didn't follow it, and after a number of years, they said, well, the U.S. hasn't joined us, so they stupidly and inexcusably went back to this threat of insane action. And I want to put to you, we'll come back to this, as philosophers, seriously, the following point. Everybody can see that to initiate omnicide, as the philosopher John Somerville called it, the killing nearly everyone, which is what will happen if we initiate that. Hardly anybody, I can't imagine anyone who would say that is a rational, sane, reasonable thing to do, calmly or desperately or anything else. But to threaten it, that's the question.
Yeah.
Is that moral? Is that acceptable? The fact is, the public, the Congress, the services on both sides have acted for 70 years now as though it was reasonable, rational, necessary, justifiable to threaten, prepare for, build, rehearse, train, to initiate war that would result in the death of nearly everyone else. And everyone has accepted the rationality of that. It's insane, but that's our species, I'm sorry to say.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about nuclear doomsday with a former nuclear war planner who was right there on the front lines in front of a live audience in the Stanford campus. We've got questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. Could you talk about the role of the Eisenhower era atoms for peace? That led to proliferation, I think, of nuclear weapons, and also the idea of trying to basically make it seem like nuclear material was good and a choice of uranium reactors as opposed to thorium reactors.
The Atoms for Peace program, initiated by Eisenhower in 1953, was actually meant as a PR program to make atoms look good, which was saying earlier the electricity would be too cheap to monitor all over the world, which has never been true, in part because of the accident and insurance aspect of those things, but it's never become really competitive in that sense. But they knew that at the time. What the effect of it was to spread reactors all over the world later in the 50s, actually, we didn't do that right away, but we said these are things that are so good for medical research, for this and for that. Nuclear weapons can be good for humanity. I should say nuclear energy, thorium, as you say, uranium, plutonium. In order to make our buildup of nuclear weapons out of the way, that's just something that's going on, don't worry about it. Let me tell you one bit of background that almost nobody knows, of great significance even to this day. Oppenheimer, whom you quoted, and David Lilienthal, who was in the Atomic Energy Agency at that point, in 1952, that's the end of the last of the Truman administration, knew that an H-bomb was coming, was feasible. They knew that for the first time in 1951. And in 52, they knew that was coming. The first test of an H-bomb, using a Nagasaki bomb as its trigger, was 1,000 times the yield, the explosive yield, of Nagasaki, which was in turn 1,000 times in Nagasaki the yield of the largest blockbusters in World War II, 10, 15, 20 tons, which were called blockbusters because they destroyed a block of city buildings. Okay, Hiroshima was 15,000 tons equivalent, and the first blast in 1954 of a H-bomb, which is most of the bombs now, they're smaller than that first one, but the first one was 15 million tons of TNT. In other words, 1 million times Nagasaki. Now, they saw that coming, so they said to Truman first, don't test the H-bomb first. First, let's go into the possibility of stopping either side from getting this, and in any case, postpone it till the next administration, and let's tell. So Eisenhower came in and was initially attracted by that idea. So they had a project called Project Candor. Candor, we'll tell the public about fallout, about, you know, what the meaning is of an H-bomb world, which is 1,000 times more than the Hiroshima bomb. They worked on that for several months for the UN speech that Eisenhower planned in the fall of 53, his first year, but the end of his first year. Eisenhower decided that was a little too grim for bad news for the world, for humanity. As a matter of fact, a lot of the scientists thought, this will be the end for humanity. So they changed the speech thing to Atoms for Peace. And they called it, rather than Project Candor, which now was discarded, to Operation Wheaties, because okay. That's what they were eating when they made this.
That's a disturbing story.
Little quip before that. At school, we had someone from Atoms for Peace come and talk to us because they were going to build a reactor down the street near Crete, Nebraska. It was Hartford, Nebraska, I forget. Then on Saturday, my grandfather and I went up to the top of the bell tower at Union College, as we did every Saturday, put on our binoculars and watched for Soviet aircraft because we were part of the Ground Observer
Corps. What year was that?
Oh, I think 54, 55.
It was not a Soviet plane that could reach the United States.
Oh, I mean.
Okay, let's take some more questions from Mario. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Hi, I'm Kelly. I was wondering, I think it's Senator Warren and Representative Smith have introduced legislation to prevent a first strike. And I was wondering, on the side of the United States, to make it illegal to launch a first strike. And I was wondering if you think that that's a reasonable action to take and if that would actually have any impact on reducing the...
You say Elizabeth Warren has already introduced that?
Yeah.
Okay. And who else?
And Adam Smith of Washington.
Yes, that's a very good idea. Elizabeth Warren's credit very much. And as a matter of fact, Adam Smith, now in the House, the Democratic leader of the Armed Services Committee, has proposed this for some years. I've talked to him about it directly. Very good. He said, by the way, it'll take some years to move us in this direction. But of course, should we do it right now unilaterally, as Brezhnev did it in 1980? Yes. But is that likely to happen? No.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about nuclear doomsday with Daniel Ellsberg, author of The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner.
Is it possible to break the nuclear wheel by ridding ourselves of nuclear weapons once and for all? Or now that the nuclear genie is out of the bottle, is a permanent nuclear stalemate the best we can ever hope for?
We're coming to you from Coverley Auditorium on the Stanford campus. We'll take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our live musical guests, the Tiffany Austin Quartet, the world as I know it is full of crooked politicians, nuclear weapons, and tax breaks for billionaires. So if you want to end the world as I know it in those respects, I'd feel fine. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about nuclear doomsday.
Dan, we're going to do something that we can do on Philosophy Talk that no one else in the world can do. We're going to make you the worldwide czar of nuclear arms control. I wish we could really do it. Your task is to break the nuclear wheel. What? So this starts tomorrow morning. What's the first thing you're going
to
do?
Oh, there would be no question in my mind right away to make the world very much safer right away is unilaterally drop the American intercontinental ballistic missiles, the ICBMs, of which we still have 400. They are vulnerable to attack. They can survive and do anything only if they go first on warning. And the warning has often been fallible. There have been false alarms, and it's by a miracle that we have not sent off our intercontinental ballistics in the fear missiles, in the fear that if we didn't, they would be destroyed. They do nothing for us if they do go first, because they can't target the Soviet submarine missiles and keep us and save the world from destruction.
So wait a minute. I think that sounds, I never thought of that, but it sounds like a decision theoretic, highly rational thing. That if we have, so we have this triad, right? If we have the bombers and the submarines, is the point that there's no incentive for an opponent to attack those because they're in some sense unattackable?
There is one, and you raised that question earlier, could there be one incentive?
Yeah.
But just to follow up what you just said, former Secretary of Defense William Perry has called for years, including in op-eds in the New York Times, former Defense Secretary, for eliminating the intercontinental ballistic missiles to make us safer and the world safer. He's joined in that by General Cartwright, who was the head of Strategic Command, so, which follows Strategic Air Command.
Wait a minute. What stops our planning elite? Yeah. What stops them from doing it?
Have you thought about what it would do to the economy of North Dakota?
No, seriously.
It's funny you say that. It's not so much the economy. There is a city which depends entirely on the manning of a Minuteman missile base there, Minor Field. I was told by somebody in Congress, very close to the appropriations process, we can't get rid of that Minuteman base with its 150 warheads, which were a great danger to us, because Minot, North Dakota, would go bankrupt, would not be there. So I said, can't you put something else there, like planes or something like that, which used to be there? He said, it's very
big publisher of philosophy books.
This will sound like a joke, but but unfortunately, it's not a joke. The answer was, it's very cold up there. the people in their Minuteman silos are nice and warm down there, and the senators from Dakota want this to be not just existing up there and not just on alert 12 hours a day, hot alert. Three seems to have more people to be in restaurants, real estate, everything up there.
I want to follow this through because this is really striking to me. There have been things that we have, the nuclear powers, at least the Soviet Union, the Russians and us, have agreed to forgo, like anti-ballistic missile systems.
Yeah.
We gave up the MX missile, didn't we, right? Carter thought about developing the neutron bomb, but didn't. All those things it seems as though the whole world could decide, well, let's outlaw, as a next step, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and then we could still have our nuclear arsenals, right? That seems like just a win-win-win. Yeah. What keeps the world from doing for intercontinental ballistic missiles?
It would be very good, and that's a very strong question, and the answer is we should have a political campaign to do that. And do we know? It's very unlikely. There is a competing existential issue, of course, and that's climate, which again threatens not everyone on Earth, not near extinction, but the end of civilization. The nuclear winter is the end of nearly everybody, not just civilization. But on the climate issue, this goes directly to your point. How did we beat ABM, anti-ballistic missiles? The scientific community lined up almost en masse, to say this can't work. It will not limit damage. We can't keep them from destroying us with the anti-ballistic missiles. That was helped by the fact that anti-ballistic missiles would have had to be all over the place, and people said, not in my backyard. They didn't want them there. But the scientists managed to beat it. Now, we have a very current thing on the climate issue. The president is limiting scientific investigation of climate.
Yeah, yeah,
this
right.
is one of the most wicked...
Yeah.
Okay, so it's 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. You've gotten rid of ICBMs. You've told North Dakota's two senators to go get lost. What's the next step?
Okay, to have Operation Candor in the world, led by the U.S., which has never occurred in any of the 9 nuclear weapon states, with a study of what the actual environmental and climatic effects will be of any of the options that the president has given. Congress has never had hearings on this. The National Academy of Sciences has not looked at it. They say we have to have a request from Congress. That was impossible under the Republicans. It's not impossible, but it's not too likely under the Democrats, because that would totally undercut the function of the Air Force. And Boeing and Lockheed, by the way, which have competed to build new ICBMs at the cost of many, many billions of dollars, very good for them. So getting rid of it is not easy. But with the Candor, if there was real study showing that, it will make no difference who goes first in nuclear war. It wasn't until 1983, 40 years into the nuclear era, that it was realized that the smoke from burning cities would be in 150 million tons, would go into the stratosphere where it would not rain out and will cover the Earth and lower the sunlight reaching the Earth by 70%, causing ice age conditions on the Earth and killing all harvests, which means that whoever goes first will cause, by its own burning of cities, will cause the destruction of itself and everybody else.
Some people from North Dakota lined up to ask you questions.
Welcome to Philosophy Talks.
Hey, thanks. My name's Stu. Back around 1970, your good friends Nixon and Kissinger put out the madman theory as a negotiating ploy. Well, now we have a true madman in the White House. What are the safeguards against the president just saying, we're going to let her loose?
There are no safeguards, and there never will be any. The president is the commander-in-chief. Nobody can appeal his decision to some higher authority. Congress has essentially ceded the notion that we have to have fast decision-making here. They're out of the process. Can somebody prevent the president? No. They can say no to him, and they will get fired and replaced within minutes by someone else.
So I want to take you to part of your book that you were an inveterate Cold Warrior when you signed up for this. You were a firm believer. And here's what the Cold Warriors seemed to believe, that Russia had global domination ambitions, and they saw the United States as the obstacle. And all of our understanding of them was interpreted through that lens, right? It turns out they had 4 ICBMs when we were talking about the missile gap and all this sort of stuff. So how did you stop being a Cold Warrior? How did that happen?
Oh, I didn't stop being a Cold Warrior till, I would say, after the Vietnam War. I was in Vietnam as a Cold Warrior, trying to save the people of South Vietnam from domination by a tyrannical communist regime. Granted, they had a tyrannical South Vietnam regime, I understood that, but we always thought that's less permanent than a communist regime. But the I thought of Vietnam, which was clearly, at first I saw as a loser, that we couldn't win, and therefore people were being killed. I thought of this even as a Cold Warrior. They were being killed to no purpose, to no effect, couldn't be justified. It ought to end. Then I read the Pentagon Papers, the early years, and discovered that from the very beginning, we had been backing a French attempt to reconquer a former colony in Indochina, which had declared its independence. And our backing that, which we did from the beginning, paying 80% of their costs, was unjustifiable from any point. So it had been an unjust war from the beginning. I didn't learn that till 1969 when I read those top secret documents. And at that point, I decided to have Operation Candor in respect to Vietnam and let other people know that. And by the way, that's a statement I've never made in 40 years. I just thought of it.
So unfortunately, we got to end this conversation. I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. I mean,
Our guest has been writer, activist, and renowned whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, author of The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. So, John, are you having doomsday thoughts? I mean, what are you thinking?
Well, I've had doomsday thoughts most of my life. But Ellsberg has facts, lots of facts. I mean, he's got facts about scientists. When they exploded the first A-bomb on the sands in New Mexico, a lot of them thought that there was one chance in a million, maybe one chance in 100,000, that this would end everything.
Right.
And they did it. It's crazy. Societies, even societies of scientists, are insane in a way that individuals mostly are not.
So the thing is, people think of this as over. They think of this as the Cold War problem. But the same strategies, the same tensions, not quite as great. Nobody believes the Russians are going to roll over the world, but the nuclear strategies are still intact. That's the thing. And the weapons are still there, and the pressures are still there. So it's reading this book and talking to Dan is kind of an eye-opener. I mean, we all worry about global warming, but we should worry about this. But anyway, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. That's apologies to Descartes. I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in our community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, quick, before the doomsday clock hits midnight, let's hear from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I grew up in North Dakota in the heat of the Cold War. The recent oil fracking boom, that was in my neighborhood, a largely treeless realm marked by hammerhead oil wells, vast fields of wheat, sunflowers, soybeans, prairie, sulfur mines, and the churning Missouri River. Dotted throughout the brown prairie, surrounded by sad little circles of greenery or mud or snow in the winter, were missile silos. We drove by them all the time, nuclear warheads underground, watched over in my mind's eye by pudgy, pale teenagers in uniform. I'm sure vitamin D deficiencies abounded, also nervous breakdowns by the dozens as they huddled lonely and fearful under the dirt and ice and fluorescent lights. Also, they were bored, with hemorrhoids, I'm sure, and they did not have smartphones or cable, not even television or radio, I'll bet, maybe a greasy dog-eared deck of cards, paperback novels by Zane Grey, nothing to eat but bologna and cheese whiz on Wonder Bread, washed down with Shasta grape, sugar-free, ha, in your dreams. There were missile silos and also an Air Force base, all within 50 miles of my paranoid little town. So if and when World War III finally erupted, we would be the first to be vaporized. No doubt. Our school didn't even bother with the duck and cover drills. What would be the point? We'd be blasted to microscopic bits before we even saw the flash. Anyway, a lot of resentment about the Cold War when I was a tad, when the powers that be tried to be reassuring. They failed miserably. Nuclear energy is clean energy. Don't worry. In the future, it will power trains and vacuum cleaners. Radioactivity is harmless. You can eat plutonium. Oh, yeah? Then why are there giant zombie ants clambering up through the drainage system? As is the American custom, fear and anxiety were filtered through pop culture. Dr. Strangelove, On the Beach, Godzilla, and other mutated monsters created by radiation. More painful even than the low-level trickle-down dread of mutants and annihilation was the indifference of America to North Dakota's probable fate. TV was all surfers and cowboys and private eyes and baseball. Fantasies and big city problems, extortion, embezzling, cigarettes and beer. James Bond will save us. Relax, if you can. Then, without warning, I moved away from North Dakota, and the Cold War ended. The missiles of my childhood were bundled up and put into storage. The silos became museums. Fear receded, but did not vanish. Some missiles went away, others appeared, as if by magic. Instead of drunken, doddering old Russian men squinting at the red button, we now had secret hideouts. Invisible fingers. Does Israel have the bomb or not? What about Pakistan? Do we go to war with Iran to stop them from getting one? And we have some portly young man in North Korea threatening to unleash missiles on the coast of California, where I live! I got out of North Dakota to get away from this stuff and live inside a Perry Mason rerun fantasy of blackmail, fraud, and frame-ups, and nuclear paranoia is a no-no. But no, the Cold War and total annihilation once again rear their ugly heads. North Dakota, in its cycle of boom and bust, moved through the Cold War and oil booms and fracking booms and back to its cold oblivion. Cold northern Swedes and Germans who settled there because they could go no further. Calvinists, we're doomed. We probably deserve it. People in California and New York like to complain that North Dakota gets as many senators as they do. Well, you take the silos next time then. Put the missiles under the Hollywood Bowl or Times Square, which will also be homeless encampments. Because America itself is a sad little town now. Better days behind us. Can't even have a parade without a corporate sponsor. No animals in the circus, nothing to watch but Avengers and Star Wars. Except if there is a next time, there won't be another next time, will there? Oh, well, maybe climate change will get us first. I'll see you in the bunker, unless I see you first. I gotta go.
Holding beneath a starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2019.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamantuan. Special thanks to Merle Kessler, Micah Cash, Momo Kuntatak, Becky Barron, Eric Westfall, and Joel Gonzalez.
Thanks also to our musical guest, Jeff Chambers on bass, Adam Schulman on piano, Leon Joyce on drums, and Tiffany Austin on vocals.
The senior producer of Philosophy Talk is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Cindy Prince-Baum. And Dan Brandon is our technical director.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or sometimes mis-expressed in this program, do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Nice work if you can get it. And if you get it, won't you tell me how?